too much wine, women and song. Too many days on the highway that I run around all night long. I take a good look in the mirror in the cold gray light of dawn. Too many nights in a roadhouse run a little good boy wrong. Running with my buddies on the wild side caused me a run of bad luck. Out all night with a roadhouse crowd, now I'm down to my last $2. Pushing way too hard, trying to live too fast, putting too many wrinkles on. Too many nights in the old roadhouse, run a little good boy wrong. Too many nights in a roadhouse, too much wine, women and song. Too many days on a highway that I run around all night long. I take a good look in the mirror in the cold gray light of dawn. Too many nights in a roadhouse, run a little good boy wrong. The blues come around when the sun went down and the day didn't fare too well. I sure did want a taste of the good life till the good times come along. Too many nights in a roadhouse run a little good boy wrong. Too many nights in a roadhouse, too much wine, women and song. Too many days on a highway that I run around all night long. Take a good look in the mirror in the cold gray light of dawn. Too many nights in a roadhouse run a little good boy wrong. Too many nights in a roadhouse run a little good boy wrong.
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy, right here in the bunker, right here in North Central Indiana. And it's a this is the 2nd of August, 2014. Let me look at my clock here. Yeah, that's right. I got to make sure I lose all track of time. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And our big website is resist.com. And our message line is 559-670-1473. And then we've you can get on there and leave any length message almost that you want. If it's a good message, I may run it on the show. That's right. We also have a backup line in case you can't reach 559. That's 641-715-3800. And then put in the pass number, which is 56890*. But that's going to be mainly for a secondary line in case we have problems on the 559 line. So you got that straight, yeah. Yeah, it's a beautiful day again here. I'm telling you, it's getting to be like was out in California where every day seemed to be about the same. Sunshiny, it's cool. It's really nice. And that was Junior Brown singing that song. Too many nights in the roadhouse. He's a truck driver. He sings a lot of truck driver songs, and he also sings a lot of, he's got one pretty famous one among country people, and that's that he's a highwayman. He's a Texas highwayman, and he's chasing cars and stuff like that for speed. And so, anyhow, I get a kick out of Junior Brown. Well, we had our first Friday last night. First Friday during the summer, they have a downtown thing, and they have all kinds of things. Sometimes car shows, sometimes dances. They got bands, they got everything. Sort of like a street fair. So we went on down there, and then last night there was motorcycle time. My God, there must have been 300 motorcycles there. And of course, it gives me a chance to go around and talk to people. And I like to talk, go up to these booths that have different agendas and pull their chain a little bit. I got a hold of one guy who's running for state representative. I put him through the paces. Unfortunately, I didn't have my tape recorder with me, or my recorder. It's no longer tapes. That's like the old school. It's like a VCR, you know. Anyhow, and I regret it because I talked to a couple of other people that were interesting. They had a what they call the Indiana Patriotic Guard, and I thought maybe this was a militia outfit. I think it may be a little bit, but I went over to sit down and talk to them, but seems like they're hooked up with this group that goes around, and if there's a demonstration at a GI's funeral, like from that Baptist church, I think it is, down south, well, they go around and protect the funeral and stuff like that. I tried to get out of him, but what else he does, they didn't sound like they did much to me. And he's 100% system man, totally pro-Israel. Israel's right. And of course, what else can they say? What else can they say? Because that's all they listen to out here. This part of the country, all the radio and TV is, you know, Fox News, radio Fox News, TV Fox News, all that right-wing stuff. And that's all they hear out here. And so I'd like to add that on tape to you, or on recorded to play for you. So I made a commitment now. Every time I go to these things and I sort of bait these people out to talk about things, I'm going to have to make sure I get it recorded and put it on the show, because by the time I get done talking to some of these people, I'm so depressed I got to go have a drink. So we went out and had a drink and sang some karaoke, and that made me feel better. So anyhow, talking to the average guy, or not even average. See, here's a guy that was a prosecuting attorney, and he's running for state representative. And here's a guy that should know what's going on, or at least admit what's going on. But hell, he did. If he knew, he wasn't going to admit it. And he kept saying, I'm going to represent all the people. I said, well, that's impossible. You can't represent all the people. So he said, so when he was standing there, and I said, what do you mean by all the people? And he said, well, you know, I try to, you know, I said, look, you mean all the people that are worth a shit, right? And he turned around and walked off. Oh, I have a ball with these people. They printed a real controversial letter of mine in the paper yesterday, too, about Israel and religion and all that kind of stuff. I was listening this morning to a MIT discussion on this Iron Dome thing they've got over there that we financed and gave to the Israelis to protect them from the terrible Palestinians, who all they've got is really rocks, and they got a few of these rockets they're sending over there. Well, anyhow, they have shown that this particular project's a total boondoggle. U.S. taxpayers have been taken to the toilet again. That it's ineffective. It's totally ineffective. It's not doing what they say, but now the Israeli government is saying it is. Because when you'll see this stuff go up in the air and there'll be a boom, and they're assuming they're knocking out these Hamas rockets, and in 99% of the time they're not. So now this last week, they put a bill through to spend $200 or $300 more million on this Iron Dome fiasco that doesn't even work. So So, you ought to write and call your congressman just for the hell of it and tell him. Because this came right from MIT. It wasn't from some web site, a false flag or anything like that. These are scientists. So, anyhow, and it gives these Israelis a false sense of security, too. Because they're thinking they're totally protected and they're not going for cover when those Hamas missiles come in. Now, the anti-missile missile that Iron Dome fires costs about $100,000 apiece. But the rockets that Hamas is sending over there only cost about $500 to $1,000. So you can see United States taxpayers going to have to really fork out the dough. Yeah. Well, here's probably something you might like to know about because it has, it's a response to some of the things I've been sending out about the terrible mistake of the Operation Barbarossa of attacking Russia during World War II, which was a very, very bad mistake that the right wing have tried to make excuses for ever since I've been involved in the struggle. But a lot of what they're putting out is false flag information. And if you dig deep enough, you'll find out that the excuse that Stalin was about to wage war in the West against Germany and so forth is just a damn lie. Anyhow, here we'll go. Note the same butchery in Nova Russia, just like Yugoslavia and now Gaza. Destroying infrastructure, targeting children, denying civilians food and water, indiscriminate bombing and shelling to create terror, attacking medical facilities and schools. This comes from the same brains as exemplified by neoconservative Zionist guru Krauthammer, who I believe is on Fox TV, who termed the 1990s a period of sleep between two eras. One of international law and the new rule of Saussian of the bayonet, i.e. the law of the jungle, brute force. This thinking was recently expanded on by one Israeli thinker who claims the right to rape the wives and daughters of terrorists. Of course, you know, to the Israelis, anybody that's opposed to the Jews are terrorists. They never say Hamas without saying terrorists first. Much like Ehrenberg, if you've ever read her books. And another who expresses the right of genocide against Palestinians by Jews. And I guess you can find that there's archives on that. While we haven't seen mass rapes of Russian speakers in Novor Russia, yet the pimp Poroshenko's TV spots of killing beetles seem to mirror the same thinking as that of a genocidal Israeli. The Ukrainian gas queen apparently prefers nuclear over CBW genocide. As for Operation Barbarossa, Hitler was under a lot of pressure to fulfill the promise to attack the USSR extracted by Anglo-Zionist bankers in return for financing and allowing the rearmament of Germany. A speech given during the Republican Convention of 1940 indicates it was wax cylinder recordings of these negotiations that led the Molotov-Von Ribbentrop non-aggression treaty between Germany and USSR. As with most things in the upper realms of British politics and banking, treachery was involved, costing the lives of tens of millions of Russians and Germans, and they laughed all the way to the bank. Yeah, that's right. Well, old Bill Clinton's at it again. Former President Bill Clinton told an audience in Australia that he could have had terrorist leader Osama bin Laden killed, but chose not to, because it would have meant significant collateral damage to innocent women and children in Afghanistan. Well, there you go. And already the information's come out that that's a bunch of bullshit. So, with this interview down in Australia, it says here, hours after Clinton spoke of his role in the 1998 decision to not attempt to kill bin Laden, the 2001 terror attack was underway in the United States. The latest recording is more than just a historical irony or a sad footnote. There have long been complaints in some conservative quarters about Clinton's actions in failing to neutralize bin Laden. It is also probably not a coincidence that there's been deeper looks at the Clinton administration's actions as his wife, Hillary, appears more likely to be running for president. The 1998 incident was previously known, but the tape is the first known recording of Clinton speaking about the decision. The Australian recording was made by a local official who told Australian news outlets it was made with permission of the former president. Bin Laden had been a target for U.S. officials for his role in the 1998 bombings of U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Kenya. The U.S. government launched missile strikes in August 1998, but bin Laden was not injured. By December 1998, intelligence indicated that bin Laden was staying at the governor's residence in Kandahar, according to the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks Upon the United States, otherwise known as the 9/11 report released in 2004. According to the report, the missing chance made some lower-level officials angry, but later information showed that bin Laden had left his quarters and was not there. The principal's wariness about ordering a strike appears to have been vindicated. Bin Laden left his room unexpectedly, and if a strike had been ordered, he would have been hit, the commission wrote. He would have not been hit. The U.S. officials again considered a missile strike against bin Laden in May 1999, but decided not to act because the intelligence seemed unclear. The situation was complicated by the accidental bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade during the NATO war against Serbia. Oh, wow. Let's see here. Okay. This episode may have made officials more cautious than might otherwise have been the case, the commission's report stated. Bin Laden was eventually killed in 2011 in a raid of which he was unarmed, and I think his wife was probably standing in front of him. Talk about terrorist. The pan can't call the plate black or whatever it is. It's ridiculous. Well, that whole bin Laden thing was suspicious as hell, the whole operation, and taking him out and dumping him in the ocean and not letting him have a Muslim burial. The whole thing stunk as far as I'm concerned. And what's amazing is how little questions. You know, there was a few questions on late night talk shows, but that was about it. Okay, we believe everything you say there, Special Forces.
I always hear from Republicans about the culture of dependency. We shouldn't be giving money to poor kids and widows and sick children and ladies who are pregnant. You know what? What about Germany? That's the real culture of dependency. Germany and Israel and Japan and Korea and all these countries, they don't need our money. They could handle it themselves.
Well, and it's not like we're giving them money to build schools or hospitals. We're giving them money in order to buy weapons
from us.
And which is the worst business plan ever, by the way. What business gives its customers money to buy its stuff?
Right.
But in the case
like a Polish protection racket.
It makes no sense.
We pay. What the...
And, you know, I think in the case of Israel as well, $3.5 billion, that's $750 per Israeli per year. And Israel is not a third world country. It's the 50th richest country in the world. It's got a GDP that's growing faster than America's GDP. And
it doesn't need our money.
These weapons are not being used to protect it from Syria or from Iran. These weapons are being used to enforce a illegal military occupation, and we're paying for it.
Call a spade a spade. They don't need the money, but what we're doing is we're buying friends. That's what we're doing. We're buying friendship. And there is something to be said. I don't know where you want to make the argument, but there's something to be said about whatever moral authority or authority you get from actually doing that on the world stage. If we took all the money back, and I'm not saying it's actually working, by the way, whatever moral authority we have these days, but if you took the money back, where do you think we would really be in that discussion? If I paid your credit card bill every single month, Bill, you'd take my phone call, I think.
Right, but
we need to show leadership for Israel. While we're on this program, the House is going to vote on Iron Dome funding on the supplemental. It may be happening right now. Iron Dome, as we've seen, has been a massive success for Israel. Israel depends on us for its very existence. Their existence is threatened every day. And it's not just Israel. The destabilization that people are trying to have in Jordan would have a devastating impact on us.
I'm a big backer of Israel. I'm just saying, I don't think you're right. They don't depend on us anymore. Their GDP is $242 billion. They don't need our $3 billion. They can stand on their own. They've been, maybe not in 1947.
I don't think Americans
can absolutely stand on their own. This idea that Israel's existence is at stake because of Palestinian terrorism is absurd. I mean, look, the issue here, I think, Andrew, you're
not their existence.
It's Islamic extremism that we're seeing in Iran, that we're seeing in Syria, that is not just Israel.
Israel is the most powerful nation in the Middle East. It has 500 nuclear weapons. It's fine.
Yes.
I don't think people in Israel think they're fine.
Hold on. I'm with him. Israel is not fine, but financially Israel may be fine.
Right.
But the money piece is a political piece. It puts us at the table together.
But to your point, you're pretending that we actually get something from Israel in Germany. We don't get anything from them. On the contrary, Israel, as we've seen regularly, has gone out of its way to embarrass our Secretary of State, call what his attempt
I'd say he's done a good enough job of that on himself. Look at the hot mic comment.
Well,
that sent a real message. It was a window into the soul of this administration. Israel has a right to defend itself, but... And that's what Israel... That's
and by the way, if we didn't give Israel the money, they wouldn't have to listen to Kerry. Haven't they suffered enough?
Yeah. Well, they don't listen to Kerry. We don't get anything for it.
That's the question. If we're actually getting something for it, I think ultimately we get more for it than we think. And I think we get even less than we do.
As long as we're on this subject, there was a ceasefire today. It lasted for 90 minutes. It's really a working lunch. But there was an article in the New York Times yesterday I thought was very interesting. It said a lot of the frontline Arab states, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, have effectively lined up with Israel.
The governments have, yes. Yeah.
Because it said their loathing and fear of political Islam is so strong. This has not happened before. What does this say when the governments, I mean, obviously they have to answer the people to some degree. They don't want riots in the streets. There are not demonstrations against Israel going on in these countries. They're going on in Europe. Why is Europe more against Israel than Arab countries?
Because Europe's a democracy. It's not news that the dictators of the Arab world don't like Hamas. That's a fact that's been around for a very, very long time. These are police states. You know, you don't allow for just freedom of expression and people to go out onto the streets and actually protest, you know, something that the government itself doesn't want them to
do. Well, why do they need to be police states? Why can't we trust the Arab world with electing people? Because when they do, they seem to get the Muslim Brotherhood. That's what these regimes are saying, is that if we don't take over, something worse happens. And I do think it is something.
Well, that's about enough of that, but you can see the way it's going there. It's not real bad, but at least they're talking about it, talking about all this money going down a rat hole and everything else. Last night when I was talking to this veteran, who must have been about 50 years old, in the conversation, I said, well, what are we getting from Israel? I said, what do you think about the USS Liberty? They're supposed to be our friends. He says, what's the USS Liberty? So I explained to him it was a ship that was sunk and 200 guys lost their lives, American veterans or American Navy men. And he didn't know anything about it. Now, here's a guy 50 years old and thinks he's sort of political and the whole bit, and they didn't know that. I mean, this is the problem we've got, is extreme stupidity that's been bred into these people in the schools. Well, here we go again. The mayor of Toledo, Ohio, declared a state emergency after the water in the Collins Park water treatment plant revealed the presence of dangerous toxins, the Toledo Blade newspaper reports. At a news conference, the officials of the Toledo Lucas County Health Department said that the level of microcystine, a cyan toxin produced by blue-green algae that can cause symptoms ranging from rash to liver failure, is currently 2.5 parts per million, more than twice the allowable level. Health officials suspect that the reason behind the high level of microcystine are algae blooms in the lakes that provide water to the Collins Park facility, but need to perform tests to verify that the algae blooms in this lake are responsible. Well, the city issued an advisory last night on Facebook urging 400,000 affected residents not to drink the water. Here's a copy of it. Urgent notice to residents of Toledo and Lucas County who receive water from the city of Toledo. Don't drink the water. Do not boil the water. So there you go. Restaurants and food service facilities that cannot guarantee that no tap water will be consumed on the premises were asked by the city to shutter their doors temporarily. Schools in the area canceled athletic practices and other related activities in the wake of the advisory. Many grocery stores and convenience stores in the area are reporting that they are sold out of bottled water. An employee at the Kroger grocery store in the affected area told The Blade that her store had sold out of water at 3:30 a.m. Quote, "It got really busy about a half hour after the city put out the notice," she said. "Ever since then, it's been nonstop at all self-checkout stations we have going." So now this is going to be happening all over the country more and more, as fracking and all kinds of other stuff are screwing up the aquifers and the water in general. So this type of thing you can expect to be happening all the time from now on. Unless, maybe not even unless, if they change their ways and quit doing the things they're doing that are contaminating the water, maybe it would turn around. Maybe it's too late. Well, whether Donald Trump is just trying to get some news, get his name in the papers or not, he's right on this particular subject. Upon hearing that doctors are considering bringing two Americans who have contracted Ebola back to the U.S. from Liberia, businessman and media creation Donald Trump took to Twitter demanding the citizens be barred from returning to the country. Thursday evening, Trump tweeted, quote, "Ebola patient will be brought to the U.S. in a few days. Now I know for sure our leaders are incompetent. Keep them out of here," unquote. This morning, he added, "Stop the Ebola patients from entering the U.S. Treat them at the highest level over there. The United States has enough problems." So there you go, which I agree with. Well, I see they're going to use Johnny Cash's old home as a rehab center. I think he would like that, yeah, because I think he went through quite a bit of rehabbing in his during his career. Now, I wasn't able to record this last night. Unfortunately, I wasn't prepared, but you can watch this whole thing on Hulu about its American Greed show, and it's the Jersey Score. And it's about this Jew, observant Jew, who defrauded people out of millions. And his main backers were rabbis. Now, during this documentary, there's one area where I wanted to record for you. And that's where it talks about the way Jews operate when it comes to money and how these rabbis operate. I'm going to see if I can find it.
The deputy mayor of Jersey City, we later found out, was a former stripper back in days of burlesque. the characters themselves made it surreal.
And as the criminal complaints are made public, they lift the veil on systemic corruption, brazen even by New Jersey standards.
The initial complaint as they first came out alleged massive bribery of ranking politicians, along with money laundering of incredible amounts associated with ultra-Orthodox community leaders, rabbinic figures. And then what stunned everybody was an illegal kidney brokering scheme that had been uncovered.
The complaints are based on hundreds of hours of secret surveillance tape. To understand Solomon Dweck, you have to understand where he comes from. Deal, New Jersey, home to one of America's wealthiest Syrian Sephardic Jewish communities. Sam Antar grew up in the Sephardic Jewish community in Brooklyn.
It's a tight-knit community that traces its origins back to 1492, the Spanish Inquisition. They were expelled from Spain, and they moved to North Africa and countries in the Middle East. To survive the discrimination that they encountered, they maintained a very insular culture, stayed together.
Solomon is the son of the rabbi of the synagogue of Deal.
But in that community, the rabbi meant everything. And that gave Solomon a level of credibility, even within a very insular community.
But instead of following in his father's righteous footsteps, Dweck learns how to pay people off to get what he wants. It's a lesson he learns in high school.
Solomon admitted that he paid off a teacher in his high school to pass him in math because he was going to fail math. So he paid him $50 and earned a passing grade.
At 19, Dweck gets his first taste of the deal.
One of his father's friends offers him a deal to flip a house. Solomon is going to fix up the house and they'll split the profits. And that's his first entrance into real estate.
At 23, Solomon Dweck meets and marries 19-year-old Pearl Sutton, whose family also belongs to the Deal Synagogue.
To you, living outside the community, Solomon Dweck may be a George Costanza from Seinfeld, but within the community, he's a George Clooney. He has all the elements that gain people's trust, and people want to be part of his life.
Soon, Dweck puts his people's skills to good use as chief fundraiser at the Deal Yeshiva, a Jewish day school.
He was taking more than $200,000 a year doing this. His wife was making $100,000. We talked to teachers and administrators at the Deal Yeshiva. Nobody ever saw either one of them.
But Dweck's idea of fundraising is blatantly illegal. He uses a common tax dodge that appeals to wealthy donors. Journalists Josh Margolin and Ted Sherman detail Dweck's scams in their book, The Jersey Sting. Here's how the tax dodge works. A donor will write a check to the school, let's say in the amount of $100,000. Of that $100,000, the school takes 10% and Dweck takes 5%.
Out the back door, $85,000 comes back to the donor. So the donor then is allowed to take a full $100,000 tax deduction as a charitable donation.
It worked out well for the religious school because they were getting 10% of the donation. It worked out well for the donor because he got credit on his income taxes for a $100,000 donation. It just didn't work out too well for the IRS.
For Dweck, it's working out so well that he branches out to other religious charities to launder even more money.
Among certain sub-elements of the community, it's a cook-the-books culture where the government is not entitled to any of their money. So they will not pay taxes at just about any cost. They will not record transactions. They'll do whatever they can to evade and not pay their fair share of taxes.
But for all the money moving through the yeshiva, the Dwecks live modestly by Jersey Shore standards in their $1.2 million home.
He didn't seem to be the kind of guy who wanted the money in order to live the high life. It seemed like the money was just a secondary piece of it. He was addicted to the adrenaline of the deal, of the chase.
By 2000, Dweck's other business, fixing up and flipping real estate is going gangbusters. And like a crazed Monopoly player, he starts buying up properties.
So you see, these communities operate as conspiratorial units, doing everything possible not to pay their fair share, not to pay any taxes at all. But of course, the IRS is full of Jews making you pay for your taxes, grabbing your stores, your houses, and everything else. So let's go on here and see what else we can find out. Too bad I can't play you the whole thing, but you can watch the whole thing on Hulu TV if you've got it.
Customers washing $585,000 and receiving the cash in boxes of Apple Jack cereal. And though the money laundering investigation is paying off, by the end of 2007, Dweck has made little headway into the political corruption side of the investigation. And U.S. Attorney Chris Christie is nearly ready to close up shop.
Chris Christie had been hard on them at this point and saying, we're not getting anywhere, we only have a bunch of money laundering cases, where are my corrupt politicians, this case is going nowhere.
But then, in early 2008, Dweck slices into a whole new part of the investigation.
In one meeting that the feds described to us in great depth, they turn to Christie with smiles on their faces and they say, we have somebody who's selling illegal kidneys.
That person is Levi Itzhak Rosenbaum, a real estate broker from Brooklyn who sells the parts for $150,000 apiece.
This is another rock that we turn over, and it turns out there's all this slime underneath it. The circumstances of grabbing some impoverished person and bringing them over here and grabbing one of their kidneys for maybe $10,000 and then turning around selling it for $120,000, $150,000, not good circumstances.
Dweck needs no introduction, as his own grandfather had purchased a kidney through Rosenbaum. So Dweck reaches out to the broker with the line that he needs a kidney for his secretary's uncle. 9 months later, Rosenbaum finds a donor. And in November 2008, the feds realize the investigation could take a perilous turn.
We obviously didn't want it to go past a certain point, past the point when somebody was being cut open. Dweck had arranged various excuses to put off actually bringing the person over to do the deed.
You know, one thing after the next with this guy. First he's sick, then he gets a virus, then he's in the hospital, now he has a mini stroke. I don't know what to tell you, it's crazy. So, these things are never simple, right?
I would like to meet this guy once.
Okay, we'll set something up. I guess these people, once something goes wrong with them, everything happens, one thing after the next. It's crazy. It's like my grandfather, the same story, every week something else.
At the feds' direction, Dweck puts Rosenbaum on ice and refocuses his energies on netting corrupt politicians. U.S. Attorney Chris Christie's main objective.
It was really part of Chris's M.O. that he was usually impatient with investigations, that he didn't want to do anything to screw it up, but it was always, let's move this, let's get it done, when can we get this done?
But in December 2008, Christie steps down, and Ralph Mara becomes acting U.S. attorney. It's now more important than ever that Dweck deliver corrupt politicians before the appointment of the next U.S. attorney, who could avoid a 30-year prison sentence, is to strike a deal with then-U.S. attorney Chris Christie. But Christie, who declined to be interviewed, is in no mood to play ball.
Chris Christie is a strategic thinker. He was always committed to getting bigger and better cases, but it's a simple equation on his part. I have a huge bank fraud, one of the biggest bank frauds ever in the state of New Jersey. Why would I get into a deal with this guy? There's no reason to do it. And that is the message that's basically sent back to Dweck's lawyer over and over and over again.
When Dweck's attorney finally sits down with prosecutors, he serves up information about a large-scale money laundering operation. Orthodox rabbis who had washed cash with Dweck during his days at the Deal Yeshiva. But Dweck also has something else to offer, something more enticing to prosecutors. Politicians on the take. Christie's ears perk up.
Typically, in New Jersey, You think it's a recipe for a bad political move to be arresting a bunch of rabbis? Christie was uninterested in it, but he wanted the corruption cases, so he went along. He put Dweck on a very tight leash.
In late 2006, Solomon Dweck is at the precipice. To become a cooperating witness, or CW, he'll have to turn on his own people and lift the veil on systemic criminal activity that's been plaguing his community for years. Dweck will have to become a Moser, a rat.
A Moser is Hebrew for informer, and it carries with it a tremendous stigma. Jews were trained, you don't turn on your own people and inform to the secular authorities because of all these centuries of persecutions.
If somebody gets caught and they help the government go after other people by agreeing to wear a wire, they're excommunicated.
In January 2007, Dweck makes a fateful decision and signs a cooperation agreement to go undercover for the government. In exchange, the feds will recommend a reduced sentence. But without knowing how far Dweck will take the government, Chris Christie makes no promise of how much time he'll spend in prison. Prosecutors will just have to wait and see.
The FBI and corruption prosecutors in the U.S. Attorney's Office were able to convince Chris Christie to greenlight this case purely on the basis of there's plenty of smoke, so there must be fire.
When American Greed returned by March 2007, Solomon Dweck, the FBI's new informant, is wired up and ready to go to work. The operation has two targets, ultra-religious money launderers and corrupt politicians.
The fact that he was a past crook or an accused crook in some ways gave him some street cred, gave him some credibility to perhaps pull off and be involved in this money laundering scheme. Those in his own community perhaps would not think that he would be cooperating with the FBI and would turn on his own community.
This is the first big test for Dweck, who must prove to prosecutors that he can stay on script and get the job done.
In his rap with the bad guys, he would lay it out loud. I'm trying to launder this money. I'm trying to take it out of the bankruptcy without the bankruptcy trustee or the bankruptcy court knowing about it. Can you convert it into clean cash for me?
Ralph Marum, first assistant to U.S. Attorney Chris Christie, says one of Dweck's early money laundering targets is an Orthodox real estate developer.
Amusingly, his office was over a laundromat, and he often referred to what he was doing. He related it to washing machines.
Those washing machines are a complex international network of religious charities, rabbis, and couriers. When they get the go-ahead, they spring into action, arresting 44 people.
When these arrests happened, they were coming in by the carload. When they left the FBI office, they were leaving by the busload. They were taking them out by the dozens and putting them onto buses because there were so many suspects in this case, they had to be bused to court.
As media inquiries pour in, acting U.S. Attorney Ralph Mara prepares for the largest press conference ever held inside the U.S. Attorney's office.
Today, we're here to announce the takedown of a large-scale, dual-track investigation. On the public corruption side, the FBI and the IRS have arrested and noticed for arrest 29 individuals, including assemblymen and mayors. On the other side, the FBI and IRS have arrested and summoned 15 members of connected international money laundering rings, including five rabbis and their associates.
On July 31st,
I didn't want to take up the whole show with that case, but it's just an example of how the Jews operate on a massive scale throughout the world with the situation of not ratting on each other and all that kind of stuff. But you can see some Jews are going to rat just like this guy did. Anyhow, I hope you enjoyed that and I hope you learned something. Better watch it down in Tennessee because the police are policing for profit down in Tennessee, where cops are robbing drivers of trucks and cars. Listen to this.
5 investigation raises serious questions about Tennessee's war on drugs.
Among those questions, are some police agencies more concerned about making money off the drugs than stopping them?
Well, at the center of this month-long investigation are laws that let officers pull you over looking for cash. And get this, they don't even have to charge you with a crime to keep your money.
As News Channel 5 Chief Investigative Reporter Phil Williams discovered, those kinds of stops are now happening almost every day in Middle Tennessee.
What you are about to see is how police agencies across Tennessee make money. A tractor trailer stopped for a traffic violation leads to a search and the discovery of large blocks containing almost $200,000 cash. Cash that officers keep on the suspicion that it's drug money.
What's wrong with having a large amount of cash?
Corwin Petrosian refuses to admit that there's anything suspicious about the stash that police discovered in the truck he owns. Officers later released his father, who is driving, without filing a single charge. And authorities cut a deal that let Petrosian come to Tennessee to get his big rig back.
If I am a criminal, if they allege me to be a criminal, why would they settle? They do not just let criminals go.
In general, it was seized because, based on our evidence and probable cause, it's illegal drug proceeds.
Still, DA Kim Helper admits what makes a Petrosian case a bit unusual is the location. The traffic stop occurred here in Smith County near the Carthage exit, but the officers work for Helper's 21st Judicial District Drug Task Force out of Franklin, more than an hour away. Her officers patrol that area under a deal where they give a cut of any cash they seize to the agency that owns that stretch of road.
It's a way to make money for your task force, honestly?
Well, you know, when you say make money, I guess it is a way for us to continue to fund our operations.
Do you have any large amounts of money, Kenny, mucho, mucho, dinero in su truck and your trailer?
In fact, Interstate 40 has become a major profit center for Tennessee law enforcement, with officers stopping and often searching out-of-state vehicles.
Is it okay that they...
It's okay.
It's because of a state law that lets them seize money, like the cash shown in these police photos, simply based on the suspicion that it's linked to drug trafficking. If an owner does not take legal action to get the money back, the agency gets to keep it all.
I mean, this is really highway shakedowns coming to the U.S.
Last year, a conservative-leaning group, the Institute for Justice, issued this report, Policing for Profit, that gave Tennessee a D- for civil forfeiture laws that make it all possible.
Under civil forfeiture, you give law enforcement a direct and perverse incentive to go out and try to take as much property from citizens as possible.
What we're doing, we're taking advantage of how the laws are to use the money to be able to put back to fight the drugs.
Dixon Police Chief Ricky Chandler heads the board for the 23rd Judicial District Drug Task Force, which has made millions off of seizures in its counties, Humphreys, Dixon, and Cheatham.
Can I search your truck and trailer?
Then 3 years ago, Chandler and the Dixon County Sheriff helped create a second team known as Dixon Interdiction Criminal Enforcement, or DICE, to work the exact same stretches of interstate.
So everything's paid through seizures and fines.
So if these officers out on the interstate don't come up with cash, then they might lose their jobs.
Well, it's a possibility, yes.
Out here on the interstate, interdiction officers have a choice. Conventional wisdom is that the drugs come in from Mexico on the eastbound side, but the money goes back on the west.
While both agencies have made some big drug cases, we spotted both the 23rd and DICE staging time and time again with their backs to the drug side. In fact, a review of daily activity sheets kept by the 23rd discovered that when officers noted the location of their traffic stops, there were 10 times as many on the money side.
We want both sides of the road worked.
It looks like that they're not concerned about stopping the drugs. They just want the money.
That's what it looks like.
Is that the case?
And that shouldn't be the case, but that's what it looks like.
It shows that the police are really focusing not on trying to get the drugs, not on trying to enforce the drug laws and stop that flow throughout the country. They're focused on getting the money.
It ain't NC.
And it can lead to turf wars. After DICE got this million-dollar seizure last fall, a DICE officer suddenly found himself being blocked in by a unit from the 23rd. Within minutes, 5 units from the 23rd are lined up in a show of force. Then there's this 2008 video where a unit from the 23rd cuts in front of a DICE unit on a stop, prompting this heated exchange.
Leave me the f*** alone! Let me tell you something, punk. You ever come up and try to wreck me out again, it'll be your last time, you understand?
And that's ridiculous for that to happen. you've got two agencies fighting to stop the same cars. Competition can be a good thing as long as you don't violate any person's rights. But they're competing for the money that they can take off of drivers. Well, they're competing to do their job.
Mucho dinero in Chicago.
It's a job that critics say has lost its way.
Law enforcement is supposed to be about getting the bad guys. It's not supposed to be about making money.
Now, law enforcement authorities say their goal is to hit the drug traffickers in the pocketbook, which undoubtedly they have. But some people have hired lawyers after their cash was taken, and sometimes after months and months of litigation, judges have ruled that the money really never had anything to do with drug dealing at all. Kristen.
You know, Phil, I'm sure a lot of people are surprised by two things. One, that officers can pull you over looking for cash.
Right.
But then two, that they could take your money even though you're not charged with anything.
Think of this. You know, it happens all the time, even when drivers might actually be involved in drug trafficking. Tomorrow night, we've got some incredible police video that you've got to see. In it, an officer tells a suspected drug courier that he can walk if he coughs up his cash. Here's a sneak peek.
Hey, I'm not asking if you have knowledge about it, and I won't ask you if you have knowledge about it. You understand me? All I'm asking you is, where's the money?
Now, this is a video that's going to cause a lot of talk and a lot of debate.
I am sure it will, Phil. All right, thanks a lot. As Phil mentioned, we've got much more online, including documents from the investigation on newschannel5.com. And also, don't keep in mind, he's got more of his investigation on the way. As he mentioned, our highway shakedown's coming to Tennessee. That's tomorrow at 10.
Pardon me for that blank space. I nodded off there. Wow, I'm telling you. So if you're traveling, find yourself traveling down in Tennessee, you better watch your step, but don't carry a lot of cash, or the local federalities will get it. And a little more alert on that Ebola stuff. Unlike most pathogens, which cannot survive long on a corpse, however, Ebola does remain infectious after a person dies. For how long remains unknown. Who notes that men who have survived the disease can still transmit the virus through their semen up to 7 weeks after recovery, providing a glimpse into the longevity of this potent pathogen. Well, I would imagine anyone that was around somebody like that would want to wait a lot longer than 7 weeks to have sex with them. In fact, probably most people wouldn't want to ever have sex with them at all. Yeah. Well, I see that the Jewish Defense League, the Keystone Kikes, are planning to establish groups all across Canada. This is from the Montreal News. Of course, this is a lot like the KKK when they boast of having thousands of people and hundreds of groups all over the place. Which the Jewish Defense League does the same thing, which I wouldn't get too excited over it. In fact, I wouldn't get excited at all over it. Well, it looks like the Le Pens are back in the saddle over in France. The leader of France's anti-immigration, anti-EU National Front would win the first round of a French presidential election if it were held today. A new poll reveals the IFOP poll for political magazine Marianne shows that Marine Le Pen would beat all candidates from the two mainstream parties, including incumbent President Francois Hollande, with 26% of the vote. Despite his ongoing legal problems, former President Nicolas Sarkozy would still run Le Pen a very close second with 25% of the vote. Seeing him through a second round runoff against the National Front leader. Hollande lingers in third place on just 17%, along with Prime Minister Manuel Valls, who is seen as his potential successor. Le Pen's National Front party won May's European elections in France, winning 25% of the vote and causing a huge political upset at home and around Europe. The next presidential election is still 3 years away, however, which may yet give the socialists and the opposition conservative UMP time to rebuild their support. Le Pen's father, Jean Marie, came second in France's 2002 presidential election, shocking the establishment by beating the socialist candidate into third place in the first round. He eventually lost heavily to Jacques Chirac in the second round, however. What happens in most of these cases is the major party adopts half of what you've been saying, and then it ends up beating you out. You know, that's how they destroy third parties. Mr. Le Pen remains a controversial issue, having previously been convicted of racism and anti-Jewism. But Marine has made a determined effort to modernize the party since taking over from her father. Polls consistently show that Francois Hollande is the most unpopular French leader in modern history, with an approval rating well below 20%. Well, I do know that when Le Pen was running for this last election, she was employing Muslims to work with her in the party. So much for that. Been betrayed so many times by people in the right wing and third parties in this country, I think we realize, or hopefully you realize, you can't trust these people. You cannot trust them. And I get in a lot of trouble for saying things like that, but it usually turns out to be true. Well, that's about it for today, boys and girls. I'll be back with you on Moon's Day. Yeah, and we'll close out with a little music here and 14:05, and remember to shut up.
Well,